Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and author of Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, is back to speak on the penal system, the need to reform prisons in the U.S., and more on her book, again, Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prisons. Mariam Jacobs has been on with us in the past as well. She is a psychosocial therapist that has been in U.S. prisons as well as volunteering in a prison in her country of the Netherlands. She has been very active in prison reform as well as her work in the psychosocial area, working with clients abroad and where she is. So I'd like to introduce to everyone again, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist from the Netherlands. And Mariam, I want to thank you for being on with us, and I really am honored to have you on, as always. So can you please let the audience know a little bit more about yourself?
Thank you, Leona, for inviting me. My introduction, as Leona said, I'm from the Netherlands. I work as a volunteer in the Dutch prison system, and I've also visited prisons in the United States, and I saw a difference between the two systems. I wrote a book. It's called Suspended Values in Concentration Camp and Prison, and in my book, I try to understand the underlying structures of the system in the United States, and I compare them to concentration camps in World War II. I did that because I also visited Auschwitz a long time ago, and of course these systems are very different, and there is a different population in both, what you can see in both systems, but there are also similarities, like the approach of the incarcerated individuals, the lack of human values, the dehumanization, and we can make a whole list of what I saw in both systems. In my work, I find it very important to meet the person behind the crime, because healing only takes place behind the crime, and I approach incarcerated people without any judgment or whatever, because that's not my area. So I try to contribute to healing by trying to find more insight in why somebody has committed a crime, what led to the crime, what was the environment that somebody has lived in, conditions and all that. And I try to make a whole picture of the life of somebody, and I do that together with the individual, of course. And then I try to find out what led to the crime and how can somebody learn from that in order not to fall back into this devastating behavior.
You know, I'm glad you're talking about that too, because you kind of like connected your deeper justice program into the theory of, with your book as well. It's all connected. And if you can just talk a little bit more about this deeper justice, because this is something that we all in this country and abroad should always know about when something occurs that is unfortunately a trauma or tragedy. So if you can talk a little bit more about the deeper justice, I would really appreciate it.
Well, deeper justice, for me, it stands more for an approach of the other, and the other can be anybody. And because in my other work, I work with people who did not commit a crime, but they suffer from ADHD or autism. And with them, I do, in fact, exactly the same as with the incarcerated individuals in prison. It's deeper stands for doing justice self on a deeper level. That's in fact what it is. And doing justice to yourself is doing justice to the pain somebody has gone through, the conditions somebody has been brought up in, the environment. So context is very important in my approach. I see the person as I see the life of a person as a puzzle, and I want to try to understand all the pieces that makes that one puzzle. So when I work with this approach, I worked for at least 1 year, and sometimes it happens I work 2 years or sometimes even 3 years, because this time is needed to get this puzzle to the surface. It's a puzzle, you know, in depth. It has to do with the soul. It has to do with emotions. It has to do with a lot of pain and all that. And in all that time, we get this puzzle to the surface. And that's very crucial. What I really see in practice is that people really deliberate. They free themselves. That's what I wanted to say. They free themselves from very painful pieces of that puzzle. And from what I see in practice is that this is the true way for somebody to really heal, to get to insight, and to change him or herself into the person he or she originally is. So it works. I only can say it really works. And it's not because I do something, but I am more like a condition for that person to get to know himself. So I ask questions when I don't understand things. I work with symbolism. I work with drawings. It's called family constellations. It's an instrument. It exists from little wooden puppets, and these puppets represent all the persons that somebody has met in his life, good persons, bad persons, and together we try to get to an understanding of what has happened, who was in one's life, what was the influence of other people in that person's life. So there are many questions to be answered. And for me, since I work with this, I really believe that this is the only real, true way for somebody to heal from the inside out. It's amazing for myself when I see somebody who has been suffering since years, and during that process gets freer and freer and becomes more and more himself and becomes happier with who he is. And yeah, it makes me very enthusiastic to do my work and to continue my work. It's a very natural process, and I wish every person, and especially people in prison, I wish that every person had the opportunity to go through this healing process.
You know, in this country, they don't really give them a chance to go through any process, and this is why I am so interested in the work that you do. One of the things is we see happening, and when people hear the word mental illnesses, they automatically think it's mental retardation. You know, they're incapable of doing anything normal like most people. And what I try to emphasize and get across to everyone is that mental illness also is a result of traumas, traumatic events that have happened in people's lives. And we have mass incarceration, as you know, in the United States of America, and many of these people have suffered some sort of trauma throughout their years. And when we speak of deeper justice, this is why I so strongly admire that word, and the work that you do with that is going into digging deeper into the causes of crime. And so you mentioned ADHD, and a lot of people probably are not familiar with ADHD, but attention deficit hyperactivity, and there's also ADD. But some of these things, I believe, are in the prisons as well. There's a lot of people that don't understand, you know, the extent of what they're doing. So if you can talk some on those issues as well.
Well, what I think, you know, when I hear you talking, what I think is when we talk about psychiatric or psychological issues or illnesses, we have to be very careful. It's very easy to use these words, But many times what I see in practice is that when there's a talk about mental illnesses, then these illnesses often are a sign of something, pain, or an issue that is lying deeper. And then you come to that puzzle that I mentioned. I've seen multiple times that I had clients who were diagnosed with issues like a social fear or depression or something else. And when we started this whole process and we were going into the process, it turned out that they did not have mental illnesses, that it was completely different, but that they tried to live to the expectations from society at the cost of who they are. So somebody, for instance, if somebody is diagnosed with a social issue, maybe that person has no social issue, but that person needs to be alone a lot. Or if somebody has a depression, okay, that's a label. But what we have to research on that depression, we have to look at that person who has a depression and then see what is your depression. Why is it getting on the surface in you? What lies behind this illness or that depression or phobia or you name it? So it's very tricky and we have to be very careful when we use these labels. Because when you label somebody, then in fact you say to that person that he's hopelessly lost. You see, or he gets medication or whatever. But these illnesses are telling a story. They are not for nothing at surface. So these illnesses, these labels are in a way signs that help me as a therapist to get to that puzzle that somebody is carrying deep inside himself. And what you see many times in psychiatry or psychology, that they try to help somebody on the surface, but they forget that we have a lot of mechanisms very deep inside of us who direct us. And we need to get aware of these mechanisms, and then we can break them, and then we can blossom. And that counts for everybody, and especially for people in prison, because they did fall down, they did commit that crime, and I also see a crime as a sign. It says something about that puzzle. It says something about what has happened here, because a person does not choose a career in crime. Most people don't do that. There's another story behind that. Nobody, no, not any child is saying, oh, I'm going to become a criminal and I want to end my career in prison. It's not a free choice. Things have happened and these things have to come to the surface. If they don't come to the surface, you cannot help somebody, because then you stay on the surface, and 99.9% it lies deeper. So, yeah. That's my comment on what you said.
And you know, it's so sad because so many people, they don't see it. You know, they don't see the things that, and I was speaking previously on cultures yesterday or the day before. One of the things is people in this country, they don't look at the various cultures throughout the country. And when I say cultures, every home has a different culture. There's no two people alike in any home. And one of the things that we have in this country is our government makes all these decisions as to how to punish people. And first, they don't do the deeper justice. They don't really look intensely into the causes behind. We have prosecutors who will tamper with evidence. You know, and they speak a lot about prosecutional misconduct and reform. They have to do the reform. But a lot of these people, they, instead of looking deeper into the reasons, the causes behind, and looking at both sides, they tend to try everything to just punish the person or the people that they're going against, that they're fighting in court. And so mm-hmm. I think it's important for people to know about the different cultures. We have a problem right now with the United States and other countries because the United States is supporting countries without knowing fully about their culture, all the cultures that are involved. And if they would just sit down and negotiate and try to learn about one another's culture, maybe the wars wouldn't be going on right now. So when we talk about prisoners, we have to look at the different cultures. Some of them grew up in ghettos. Some of them grew up in poverty-stricken areas, in domestic violence homes, you know, in violent homes, drug addict homes. And others, they grew up without a parent or without parents. And there's people that grew up in normal places in middle-class areas, but they didn't get that support that they needed, or something was missed because people did not check into why they were the way they were. So there's so much involved in cultures and all of these things that you work in is very, to me, is very valuable because people should learn to do exactly what you're doing, is digging deeper into the causes of crime, digging deeper into the causes of anything.
Yeah, I think culture is a very important part of that puzzle that somebody is. And what I think, you mentioned it very right when you said that's very missing in all these world's problems that we have now, like the wars. We condemn Russia, but who of us have ever been in Russia? What we do in the West, and that's not only in the United States, I think it's in the West, you know, in the overall, everywhere in the West, we don't realize that we are only have our Western perspective, but that's only one perspective on the world. There are many more perspectives, and they are different from ours, but our perspective is not the truth. No perspective is a truth. Every country has its own culture, but also its own perspective in the on the world. So in Russia, you might find values that we would not like, but Russians have the right to have their own values, the same as we have the right to have our own values. But from the West, we try to suppress our values on other countries. And that's very respectless. That's also, in fact, a form of dehumanization. You can see that in, you know, on a macro perspective between countries, what's happening in the world, but you also can apply it to an incarcerated individual. If you have five incarcerated individuals and they all five grew up in a ghetto and all five did not have a father and all five committed a murder, then still the persons are completely different and the stories are completely different because you have also character. You have somebody has a higher, a higher level of thinking, and other people have a lower level of thinking. Both is okay, but it makes the puzzle different. It makes the person different. So it's very individual. But we tend to, you know, also on an individual level, we tend to hold on to our own perspective, and we only want to hear other perspectives that are the same as ours, because then we feel safe, and we are afraid to learn from other people's perspectives. And I think that's a very big problem, and that's in the United States because you have this racism issue. Your country is based on racism. It's from the first day of history in the United States. And that's a very big problem, you know. If you would turn that coin, then all the cultures could learn from each other and keep respecting each other's perspectives and learn from it. But don't try to change the perspective of somebody else, because that's very disrespectful, and it's a form of dehumanization too.
I agree, and that's what it is. A lot of people in this country, even in Massachusetts where I'm from, and we have a caller I'm going to get to in a second, but one of the things is, if you don't agree with me, then I'm your enemy. That's the attitude that people have, you know, in this country. If you don't agree with me, then you know, you're my enemy. And unfortunately, they fail to realize, as you mentioned, everyone has their freedom of speech, and everyone has the right to be able to express their views without having to deal with...
Exactly. And I think when you talk about... Sorry, but when you speak about freedom of speech, I think that freedom of speech comes with responsibility. We have the freedom to say whatever we want, but we also have the responsibility to respect the other person. And we use this freedom of speech, but we don't take the responsibility that's connected to this freedom of speech. You know, I could offend you, but I respect you, so I don't want to offend you. And that's respect. That's because I respect you. You know, so you don't always need to say everything that comes up in you. You also can think about what does it do to the other person when I say this or that. But we have become a nation, and that's also what I see in Europe, that has not learned to take responsibility for the other person. And that's very frightening for me. That's scary.
We had she was a president of Harvard. She was a president for 6 months. I believe it was six months. And someone had asked her a question, and she gave an answer. It had something to do with anti-Semitic issues. And she answered the question, and it wasn't to the... And I think she was actually set up. But because of her answer, she was... She was not forced to resign, but she was forced to resign with the threats that she was getting. She suddenly started getting death threats. She started getting harassed. She started getting really, it was unbelievable. And she had a lot of support within Harvard and others to remain as the president, but it became so intolerable that she ended up leaving anyway. And this is just one example of what goes on in this country when people are not in agreement with the agreement of others. And that is the sad situation. But I want to, I'm going to unmute, and we have a caller 508. Do you want to state your name, please?
Hi, Leona. It's Donna Winant. It's so good to hear your voice. It's great to hear from Miriam Jacobs. I learned so much from her. I wonder how she gets all that wisdom and able to articulate such humane philosophies. So I'm here to listen and learn. How are you all doing?
Hi, Donna. It's nice to hear your voice again. I hope you're doing well.
Yeah, I'm running two organizations. I sort of inherited one when one of our family members, you know, from the hospital, he was burnt out health-wise, and I sort of got nominated without being asked. So I'm leading out. I'm actually going to do a PowerPoint presentation tonight on how to advocate effectively and, you know, hopefully teach a little bit of what I've learned to my fellow advocates. And one of the things I've learned, you know, or one of the things I point out is how I learned to advocate, which was by instinct, advice, experience, workshops, books, and the advice. I am actually mentioning Leona, that, you know, she has really helped me to network and open my eyes and how to get resources. So, you know, we're such a help to one another, and just grateful for the two of you ladies. So grateful.
Donna, I want to thank you for coming on. Real quickly, I also, if you can, let the audience know the organizations that you run. Donna is the founder of, and she'll explain. But one of the things, the reasons I'm really glad she comes on is because Donna is in sync with Miriam Jacobs, the psychosocial therapist. She deals with the mental issues, and Donna is also working with mental issues, trying to get people like Department of Mental Health more involved in, not more involved, but involved in going in and meeting with these incarcerated individuals with mental health issues. So, Donna, if you can real quickly, too, let the audience know about your organizations.
Thank you. Well, Organization number one is Family and Friends of Individuals with Serious Mental Illness, and we advocate for those who become justice involved. So, you know, basically we're looking for treatment and not punishment in a penal system for a disease no one chooses. But now that they are entrenched, I say enmeshed, within that criminal system, criminal justice system, you know, we're fighting to get a continuum of care, comprehensive care, especially for those with serious mental illness and mental illness trauma. There's such a large population within the prisons. It's you know, I call it the criminal justice system. It really needs reform, but heartening is that I attended the hearings, or I listened in, and I did a written testimony a week ago. 30 inmates were able to. They were wonderful. They articulated. They brought me to tears. It was heart-wrenching. And they are advocating for the issues, Leona, that you so wonderfully teach us about. Issues like the need for transparency, the need for the media to be able to go in, the need for better visitation. There was so much on the table. And our bills, House Bill 2063, Senate Bill 1239, is an act to transfer Bridgewater State Hospital from the Department of Correction to the Department of Mental Health. And that is so, so needed. These people are, you know, are subject to abuse. The word brutality was used in one of the Disability Law Center reports. And February 7th, these bills are coming up, and I'm just praying that they get passed. So basically that, you know, entails the work that I've been doing along with my fellow advocates working very hard.
Will you girls take over for a few minutes?
Sure.
Yes, of course. That's
so, Miriam, latest update with your work? What, you know, where do you feel like you're going and want to go? And, you know, you've had a long history. So, you know, where would you say you are now?
Yeah, well, I'm still working with the incarcerated and also people who are not incarcerated on a personal level. So in this healing process, I don't know if you heard me explaining it in the beginning of this radio show, if you were on or not.
I didn't get on till 1:15. I actually just saw the link on my phone and said, oh, Miriam Jacobs is on. And that's when I popped in. If I had known ahead, I would have popped in at 1 o'clock. But I didn't realize until 1:15.
Okay. Yeah, I had explained what I'm doing now with the people incarcerated or not incarcerated. And I was explaining this deeper justice idea, that I help people to do deeper justice on a deeper level, doing justice to themselves on a deeper level. And that's what I do. And most of the time, these processes that people are going in, these healing processes, in fact, they take at least a year. I take a long time with these individuals for them to heal themselves, to get to insights on a deeper level. And I also can call it sometimes that they have to get aware of their own puzzle, all the pieces, you know, the life pieces. They have to put them together to get the puzzle complete that they are carrying deep inside themselves. And for incarcerated people, it means that it is about what happened before somebody committed a crime. Can be a cultural thing, and it's personal. There are so many influences on life somebody before he comes to that moment that he has committed the crime, that he's going to commit the crime. And it's so important to get all this to the surface in order to really understand, come to understanding, and really getting able to change from within. And we also talked about psychiatric illnesses, because I also have people with, you know, they have psychiatric problems, or psychological problems. But I also said I always am very careful were using these words, because I've also seen people who have been diagnosed and the diagnosis turned out to be wrong, and that other things were happening. And what I see many times when people talk with psychiatrists often, not always, often try to help people to heal on the surface. But I always say you have to go deeper. People, we all carry mechanisms, psychological mechanisms to survive. They are built up from the youth. And I try to get these mechanisms aware, that they become to the surface. And then somebody can really get an understanding of his behavior, why he did what he did, and all that. So that's what I'm still doing on an individual level. Always try to dig deeper.
I think it's such a wonderful thing that you have access to help these people. You know, it has to be so rewarding and it's so needed. We had a meeting with Mass General Hospital, one of the doctors, Dr. Faith Scanlon, and her research is in persons with serious mental illness and incarceration. So, you know, right there we collaborate. And she was saying she has this program that helps the inmates to learn, you know, what risk factors led them to, you know, the incidents that happened. And she offered to go in. This is the second time now within several years that Mass General Hospital, you know, they're associated with Harvard University, has offered to go into the jails for no cost. And because, you know, and they're not allowed in, they're rejected, you know, and it's, you know, the DOC, the Department of Corrections, has its answers. Well, you know, we have different units, it's a matter of timing, spacing, you know, so
yeah.
We get these reasons, but, you know, there's help to be had, and it's being rejected. And last night we had my grassroots organization, we had our monthly steering committee, and one of the steering committee members has a loved one who's incarcerated, you know, with SMI. And she feels like there's such futility in some of our efforts, futility. And she has no say and no way to advocate for her son. At least at Bridgewater State Hospital, we do have some communication with the administration. We have to fight for certain things, like just getting a second helping of milk per day, with crazy things for fighting for bathroom breaks during visitation, you know, warmer blankets when people are cold. We shouldn't have to fight for those, but we do have at least an avenue. And, you know, with the prison system, there's no avenue, and she feels a futility. So I emailed her this morning, and I reminded her of a statement that she had posted in our blog. And it says, if you don't mind, I'll read it. It's not very, very long. Mm-hmm. Is that okay?
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. So, you know, this man named Brian Stetton from the Treatment Advocacy Center, on his retirement, this is what he wrote. I wish I could say that all my advocacy efforts turned out well in the end, but this work requires a fairly high tolerance for frustration. The question lingering in the back of my mind of any advocate is always, am I making a difference? When the wrong to be righted is deep-seated, complex, and decades in the making, there will inevitably be grist for discouragement. But we must never discount the many dents we make by improving state treatment laws and helping communities make use of them. Each small victory rescues some number of human beings from the ravages of untreated SMI, and each sets the stage for the next, bringing us a little closer to the day when systemic dysfunction will be a bad memory. So, you know, that, you know, I sent her that to try to encourage her, because, you know, she just feels we've worked so hard for years, and sometimes you don't get anywhere, but the little victories is that we, you know, it took months, but we got a second helping of milk for the patients craving it. It took months, but we got warmer blankets so that they're not so cold and can't sleep at night, you know. So even the little differences, you know, make a difference. But it's such a big, you know, systemic, huge problem. I'm fighting unions. I'm fighting state monies. I'm fighting all of that. And I think, you know, some of the frustration with the medical doctors and psychiatrists and psychologists, they learn their basic knowledge in medical school. And I think some of them do not move on to progress to newer, more progressive methods like brain scans and different ways of treatment and, you know, working harder toward recovery. And that's discouraging in some ways.
What do you think that the reason is that the penal system is so, it is very difficult to get things done in the system, you say. You have to be very persistent, and you have to be very patient. What, in your view, is the reason that the system is so resisting? Because it's a form of resistance against advocates.
That's true. Let me just ponder that a minute. I think one of the major problems is the lack of accountability. There's a report. Now, this is a prison associated with Bridgewater State Hospital. It's part of the complex. It's not, you know, the hospital, but it's part of the complex at Bridgewater. And there was a report out of they actually had COs sniffing drugs from the desks. There were reports of sexual abuse of the patients there, of the inmates there. And then there's, you know, when we try to mention it to the superintendent, well, it's under investigation. And then there's no accountability. We see with the Disability Law Center. Now, they are the mandated federal reporters to protect the disabled. And yet, I've got, you know, I've right in my file cabinet, I print out twice a year I print out the Disability Law Center reports. I mark them up, you know, I mark the problems, try to work on those issues to get them solved. And I had to do some, I had to do some public speaking. So I got the files out, and I've got from 2021, you know, and every 6 months, and nothing, so little has changed. There is a resistance, but it's because even though it says that the chemical restraints they used are illegal, we've reported it to the legislature, they're illegal the way they use them, and then nothing happens. It goes on and goes on and it goes on, and it's disturbing, really. One of
you know
the
what I find?
Legislators. Go ahead.
I was just going to say real quickly, one of the things that I'm seeing now is that the United Nations is actually getting involved in starting to criticize the United States for the, you know, the human rights, the abuses and everything else. And the Department of Justice is finally starting to see it themselves because of the mass incarceration. So Department of Justice in the United States is also looking at all of these reforms. And Donna, you mentioned, something like 50 new bills that are out to address a lot of these issues.
Right.
Yeah, but
getting back
to what you were talking about, I'm going to put myself back on mute and let you finish talking.
No, it's good, Leona. I think that's the line of, you know, it's like the lifeline, the rope when you're hanging off a, you know, you're down at the bottom of the cliff and you need to get to the top. You know, it's the rope having these bills.
Maybe,
it's the hope.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, what you said is it might be a lack of accountability, you know, when I ask you that question. It makes me think of what I said earlier in this show to Leona. We were talking about free speech, and as I said, we have the freedom to say whatever we want, but we forget that we also have the responsibility towards another person when we speak. And that makes, and it sounds a little bit like what you say, there is this accountability that is missing. And I think another thing, what is a very big problem in the system is that the indifference towards inmates. They don't care about quote unquote, the inmate. They don't see the human being anymore. They see the inmate, the label inmate, it is in fact. And they don't simply don't care. They, for as long as they make the money, it's okay. And indifference is even more dangerous than hate, because when you hate somebody, you can have a fight. But if you are indifferent to somebody, the other person is paralyzed. The other person cannot do anything and back, you know. And that's what I see in the prison too. So this lack of accountability, as you mentioned, but also a kind of indifference. They don't care about these people because, well, they committed a crime, so they are finished. That feels hopeless.
Hey, Mary, respect is a lot, means a lot.
Yeah.
And when you mention respect, this is one of the things that that I have to say I admire about Franz Dow and some of the people that have come on the show. They from the Netherlands, Amsterdam, they talk about treating the people incarcerated, they're human beings, so treating them as human beings, showing them respect, and you'll see the respect coming back, you know, recipient of that same respect. So this is what's lacking in this country, in the penal system, is the respect towards the incarcerated individuals. And I think if the correctional officers, the prison officials, the commissioner or warden, if they started to show in interacting with the incarcerated, I think if they started to show some respect themselves and humanity, as you mentioned, I don't think that we'd have the problems that we're having in the U.S. prisons as far as the abuses go. And
I think you're right, Leona, because I think, and that's what I wrote in my book also, is what I see is a role reversal. The criminal, let me use that word, the criminal in the street becomes a victim in the prison, and the criminal, the guard in the system becomes the criminal. So how can this incarcerated individual learn from his mistakes and become a better person, just when he is treated on such a dehumanizing way, you know? So what he sees in the prison is what, you know, is the same as what he saw on the streets. You know, when somebody has a lot of issues like poverty, growing up in gangs and all that, and he comes into prison and he sees exactly the same, and he sees how guard or other staff is indifferent towards the individual, or the individual is dehumanized. How can he become a quote-unquote better person? And I think, I don't know what a better person is anyway, because we all have light and dark sides in us. That's inherent inherent to being a human being. I have good parts and I have bad parts, and so have you, and so all, we all have that. But the example the inmates get in prison is so negative, is so dehumanization. I mean, there is no healing possible in such a system. I've been in that system, and I felt this oppression. I felt that I had to walk on eggshells, not to say anything wrong, do anything wrong in order to keep the visit safe. I felt, when I was in the system, you know, I felt as if I had committed a crime. There's so much oppression. There's so much power. It's this overpowering of people. It's disgusting. And I wrote about it in my book. And that's the system itself. And staff, inmates, families, they all are part in the system. But the system itself is sick. And still, it's functioning. Because it makes so much money. We have talked about it. It makes so much. There's so much money involved. Millions of dollars are involved in incarceration. Don't forget that part. And abuse of amendments. Sorry,
exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. No, what I was going to ask you girls, I'm losing the train of my thought, though. I wanted to go back to the mental health. I don't know if you saw it, Mariam, from the Netherlands, but some countries saw it as well, international. There was a male that was going before a judge, and Donna, you saw it because it did go national, and a former judge had ordered this prisoner to be evaluated by behavioral evaluation, and the psychologist found him competent to go before the judge, and as a result, this individual leaped over the judge's bench to try to attack her. He got He was brutally beaten, and he ended up getting another 4 years added on to his offense. The first thing that came to my mind is this psychologist that found him competent, to me, was not competent himself. And I believe that this is the kind of psychologist that gets hired as a contracted provider in a lot of the Department of Corrections around the country. They're not qualified themselves. They're not experienced themselves. No. They're getting hired in these Department of Corrections because of cheap labor. And as you mentioned, and as
exactly.
a lot of times, the incarcerated individuals do not receive the treatment that they're desperately in need of. And that's the way I looked at it with this incompetent psychologist that found this individual competent to go before the judge, only for the individual to try to attack the judge and get brutally beaten and end up getting 4 years more added on. This is a major issue.
It's really amazing.
But I just want to real quickly, we have another caller, so I'm going to take them off mute. And okay. 615, you want to state your name, please?
Sure. I'm Kyle. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can, Kyle. Welcome.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. If you can tell the audience and Mariam and Donna a little bit about yourself and your situation, and let us know what you think about the feedback. Give us some feedback on what you've heard so far.
So I can't give you honest feedback. I just saw the topic, and I was like, oh, shoot, yeah. Sorry to give you so late. But this is I'm Kyle. By the way, I'm Kyle Robinson. I'm an advocate for incarcerated people. What I do is direct assistance. So that looks a little different for everybody. For some people, it's building social media or web development. For some people, it is training them for public speaking. For some people, it's just answering the phone. And the first person who drew me into this advocacy is someone who was, like myself, sentenced as an adult when they were underage, and he spent 34 years in prison. He just got out yesterday, and that's why I was late today to tune in, because I was kind of rendezvousing with him. I can't give feedback, but I'm happy to speak to the topic, and I'm honored just to listen.
Well, I'm glad the individual is free now. It's not often we hear of freedom in this country anymore with mass incarceration. So it's really good that he was released yesterday. And will you be working with them, continuing to work with them? Or will someone be working with them beyond?
Absolutely. I'll be working with them. And I did hear one thing before I started talking that I wanted to speak to. And I think it was you, Miss Liana, who mentioned it. The experts, and I'm using air quotes here, the experts that are often hired or contracted by investigators, they have, just like anybody else, when you go to work in the morning or during the day, you want to get paid, you want to get compensated because you have things you have to do. They're no different. They are no different. If the defense has the means and the competence to hire an expert, they can usually refute that testimony or offer some type of counter, another plausible explanation than what the prosecution's witness or expert offers. So there's a lot of credence lent to these non-experts. And in fact, I was reading a study. I could pull it up if you give me a few minutes. But there was a study done specifically on this that it explored the basically the weight that jurors lend to these experts and how often they can be wrong. And this is particularly important given the knife edge of time that we're on, the knife edge in history, where we have people on both sides of the DNA understanding timeline. So you've got jurors who often don't have any more insight or research or expertise. They're going to go off what they heard that was most convincing. And it's usually coming from the prosecutor's witness, and it's usually not contested. And that's a problem. A lot of people have lost their freedom behind that circumstance. And it's not a one-off. I've seen it happen a lot of times, and it still does happen.
I never thought of it that way, but you're right in that area. You really are right. And the jury of the citizens, but they're not fully informed. It's like one-sided stories with the media. But one of the things that Donna and Marion were talking about, too, are the mental health issues. And again, I think, Kyle, you were on the other day when I was interviewing someone else, and we were talking about the mental health issues and how people assume that mental health, it just means mental retardation. But they don't look at the traumas and the past history of violence the environment that they grew up in. So this is what they've been talking about.
I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say,
you know, Dr. Joy DeGruy, who wrote that book, Post-Traumatic Slave Syndrome, brought a lot of awareness to transgenerational trauma. You cannot, well, I'll put it like this. I'll put it like she put it. You had people who weren't at the site when 9/11 happened. People who just saw it on TV and they were diagnosed with PTSD. People who weren't even there. You have, in our experience, I don't know who I was on the phone, but you have a legacy of violence, unprecedented violence, in which, I mean, it's too revolting to specify. And we're supposed to pretend or operate as if we're not impacted. We are impacted, unfortunately. And it doesn't make something wrong with us, but it does mean that there is trauma. And when that trauma, it's like a virus. It's like a mucus. If it can't come out naturally through processing, it's going to find its way out by whatever means that is, and oftentimes not when you want it to. Well, it's the same way with trauma. That trauma causes us to reenact on others this harm that we've experienced. And because that trauma is not addressed and because it's not recognized by the system, because they would have to pay the bill on it, and you know they don't want to do that, then we are punished for processing the trauma or exerting it however we can, as if it's up to us. And that's just not how trauma works. But when you were talking about the mental health issue, it was really personal to me because I have an older brother who is, he's 4 years older than me, and I don't know if you've ever seen that movie Rain Man with Dustin Hoffman and Tom Cruise.
He has autism.
Is exactly like, okay, yes, he has autism, and the definition or the understanding has expanded over the last decade or so, but when Ryan was born, it was not as easy to get diagnosed. He operates like a 6-year-old socially, even though he's 41 now. And part of my life, we grew up in a white area where we were surrounded by white people. And it was a good old boy type of town. And it was such an emotional burden to have to stay with him all the time, to be able to tell him as an older brother, you know, you can't go to the park right now. You can't go by yourself because the neighbors, they just see your body. You're a large guy. They think, well, he's, you know, he's normal, is what they would say. And with the type of officers in this area, it's very plausible. I've been arrested there. It's very plausible that one of them, you know, pulls you over or while you're walking down the street and asks you for your ID, as they've done me. And if he, you know, if he doesn't understand what cooperate means in the same way, and he's no harm to anybody, but he's not going to follow instructions the same way, which is why someone had to always be around him and looking out for him. But I saw a lot of people just like him in prison. And that's a part of why I can't let this work go. If people knew the amount of mental health neglect cases that are in there, that we're calling prisoners, we're calling criminals, we're saying lock them up and throw away the key, but they're just like my brother. It's not fair. That's all I'll say.
Do you girls have any feedback or anything to add to that or respond to that?
Well, I think if you don't walk the line as is expected from society, and you are different, quote unquote different, then you can get into trouble. I think we have high expectations from each other, but we do. But at the same time, we don't see each other anymore. We have become blind for the real person who somebody is. I cannot hear anything anymore. Sound is gone.
Oh.
Hello? Hello? Hello?
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah.
Hi.
Oh.
Hi.
Oh.
I got cut off. I called back in.
Oh. Okay, Donna, did you hear what Marion was saying and also what Kyle was saying?
I did, and I couldn't agree more. I agree 100%, and it's so true that people with autism or mental health issues, they don't always know how to comply. They don't always know how to comply outside of jail if there's law enforcement involved. They don't always know how to comply or capable of complying, you know, inside a jail or prison, which is why I, you know, just advocate and fight so hard that treatment is needed and not punishment for a disease no one chooses.
And I want to say one of the things, and Miriam, you and Donna probably can agree with me because you're both in that fighting in that area, but one of the things is when you have people incarcerated who are going through a lot of ADHD and ADD and also traumas, as Kyle was mentioning as well, one of the things is they need quiet, and I know it's very difficult to have that peace and quiet in a prison system. But I always say, I don't know why they don't have music, soft music throughout the penal system. Having soft music just to...
But then you come back to what I mentioned earlier. When I visited the prison system in the United States, I felt the indifference towards incarcerated individuals. They don't care. And that's dangerous. That's very dangerous if you are indifferent. If I am indifferent towards you, then I don't care what happens to you. I don't get it. I don't care. So you are paralyzed because you can say whatever you want. You can do whatever you want. I simply don't care. And that's what I see in the system.
And I think the legislative members, the lawmakers, this is what's so pathetic. Because the very people, and our taxpayer dollars are going into these government workers, that these people should be challenging. They should be challenging the penal system. They should be challenging the commissioners and the wardens and the prison officials, the administration, because people incarcerated with mental health issues, and there's a large, large, large portion, they need this help. And when they don't get this help, when they're treated worse than when they went in, then that means they're not going to be healed. They're going to have that anger building up inside all over again. And this is why we hear of riots going on in the prisons. This is why we hear of food strikes going on, because no one is doing anything about it but talking about it. We
exactly.
have legislative, we have a government that, look at Greg Abbott from Texas. This man is so hateful. He has the highest rates of executions in his state. Look at what he did. He put up all that, and I know there's an immigration issue, but he put up all that barbed wire with all the razor sharp things, and they're trying to get him to take it down. He won't. And look at the mother and child that drowned because Greg Abbott wouldn't let his border patrol allow this woman and her child in. She drowned right there on the spot. This is why it's so pathetic that we have lawmakers that have that kind of hatred, that kind of anger and racism and everything else in them, that these people are not getting help. And the media, the media has been reporting all morning about these police officers in Massachusetts, and there's a lot more involved. Donna, you probably heard about it. These people were giving out, allowing the CDL licenses to these tractor-trailer drivers that otherwise would not pass, in favor of getting new their driveways tarred and new tractors and trailers, and they were benefiting off of these people. And now all of these police officers, these men are in, and they're going to find, they said several of them, in addition to the two they were arresting this morning, but they're probably going to find out there's a chain of them that are out there in some kind of a scam. These are police officers. So where is, I would just like to know what the difference is between human beings and human beings. Human beings with titles and uniforms and human beings without uniforms. Tell me, please, somebody tell me.
Well, I think when you look at mass incarceration, there is a hidden agenda. There are parties that benefit from mass incarceration. That's why it's there. If you look at the war between Russia and Ukraine, here in the Netherlands, everybody is against Russia, and they say, oh, Russia this and Russia that. But you have to understand, right after the invasion of Russia into Ukraine and Russia came to an agreement to end it. It was within 2 weeks. But then the United States and Great Britain, they went to Zelensky and said, no, we don't want you to agree with Russia. We want you to have this war. Nobody's talking about that. And now I read how much money the United States is making by selling all these weapons and all that. So there is so much more than what we see in the news. That's why I don't take a side, not in any war, except Gaza. Gaza is exactly like World War II. That's insane. But there is so much that we don't know. There's so much money involved in everything. And it's also with mass incarceration. Millions of dollars are involved. It was 2 years ago, I think, Leona, that I sent you a article from a United States paper, and it said that there was a prison in one of the states, I don't know which one, and it was emptied. There was only half of the prisoners. It could house many more people, and they sued the state because they lost money. I mean, what are we talking about?
Mm-hmm.
And that's,
you know, in some places where those contracts come up short, because as you're saying, those beds are promised. They're guaranteed a certain amount of beds to be filled, which means a certain amount of people, enough people need to be arrested. Otherwise, the taxpayer pays for that. So what they've started doing is leasing their prisoners to other states to be housed in other states to fill up their beds to manage their loss. It is insane.
It is.
Incentivizing people to, or paying people, allowing people to benefit off of the caging of other human beings.
Yeah. It is in fact a way of making money by locking up living bodies. That's what it is for some parties. They don't see incarcerated individuals. They don't see human beings. They see money. And that's why you also see this playing with the amendments. I wrote that in my book too, the Eighth Amendment, the voting, that incarcerated individuals are not allowed to vote. There is so much manipulation, and it's difficult to grasp. And that's what you see back in all these stupid rules that you see in prison. If advocates want to have things done, what they have to do, all the steps they have to take, it's And these rules and prisons, so many times they don't make any sense. What
yes.
Donna said, they have to fight to get blankets into the prison. What are we talking about? It's nonsense, but it serves the dehumanization in prison, because when we get the prisoners to become aware of themselves, to become aware, to heal themselves, then we have a problem, because then they are healed and they don't make mistakes again, and we cannot make money of them again.
You speak on that a lot, Miriam. So can you just explain what you mean by that with these large corporations that are benefiting?
Yeah, it's you have to privatize prisons, but I believe it was about a few percent of prisons are privatized, but there are these very large industries like the food company, the healthcare company, somebody who wants to start a prison, you can start a prison. You need furniture in the prison, you name it. These companies, many times they have long going prison industry. They are that contract, that money. And they try to make the food as cheap as possible, make as much money as possible. And that's only the food industry. But then you also have the phone company. You name it. There is so much. The healthcare companies, they make so much money out of incarcerated individuals. It's about millions of dollars. So if these prisons would be empty, then the money is lost.
You know, recently,
and to keep the prisons full is also what they use, and the wars, the public, they make public afraid of these quote unquote criminals. You know, they paint a kind of picture, a negative picture in the media, and the media is also a part of these big corporations. What you see in the media, they only tell you what they want you to know. They want the public to be angry at people who commit a crime. They want to have them judgmental. They only show them one part of the story. And then you have the movies. You have all these Hollywood movies about, the big criminals and how bad they are, and they have to be punished. So that way you create an image of the criminal. The criminal does not exist, but they believe in it. So they support mass incarceration, lock them up and throw away the key and never let them out again.
No, you're absolutely right. If I may just stand where you're at or take it a step further and introduce to you the word, or to us, because it's the word missing right now. It's incarceracism. What does that mean? That refers to a philosophy and a dismissive approach that we all have experienced when trying to spread awareness of this specific issue. What has happened is the way that our country has historically seen and treated people of color has simply expanded or shifted to be the way that we see incarcerated people now.
Yeah.
They're not treated as human. They are seen as less than. Whatever you do to them is fine, because it's not like they're somebody's kids who I know or somebody's kids who I love. They're not really human, and therefore, once that absence of humanity is opened, there's just no limit to how you can treat people, and that lines up exactly with what we see today. I coined that term not because it's catchy, for two reasons, because it speaks to this thing that we're all trying to identify, that we know we feel. We see it every time we talk to somebody about this issue, and they don't return with empathy. But also because you can, in 2024, go through public high school, public education, and college, and learn about racism and learn about incarceration without ever understanding the bond between the two. And that's ridiculous because they've gone together since we've been recording history here. And that's all I'll say right there.
You know, I think that that's true. But at the same time, I think what's happening in this country, too, is that when we talk about the racism that goes on in the penal system and that's gone on for years and years, and it's very true, we also have to look at we can't just blame one race because I'm going to say this to be frank. It's our own, too. They're a problem as well. Because as I mentioned
Absolutely.
Earlier, I tried to get Al Sharpton to use his platform on CNN News so that he can have a platform on the issues, the mental health issues of the incarcerated throughout the country. And that's something he just completely ignored because he's too busy worrying about overseas. He's sitting with these people on a round table talking about Ukraine and Russia and all of these things. And he's talking about Donald Trump and all of these things. Well, the problem is in this country, the problem right now is not Donald Trump. I could care less who gets in until we the people come together and have this platform about the penal system because the penal system is a major, major problem. And look at what happened with NAACP, too. They backed away. They went AWOL. Black Lives Matter, you never hear of anything except the funding. And you go on the internet and you see all the monies that they have walked away with and still have done nothing. I'm furious with a lot of white people in this country, believe me, because there's a lot of racism in this country. But I'm also furious with these blacks that when it's to their convenience, then they're advocating for their own. But when it's not to their convenience, these people are opportunists. Now, when
Absolutely.
We have people in this
Absolutely.
Country that come together, we come together, we start working together in unity to try to resolve these issues and ignore these racist whites and ignore these others that are opportunists of our own color. That's what we need to look at. We need to be real. We have a mental health issue and addictions. Mental health and addictions that we need to look at.
But I believe that mass incarceration mainly started, I don't know, was it with Nixon? And that he, in fact, exchanged the word African-American with criminal. And that was a way to lock up to disrupt the black communities in that time and to lock up a lot of African-American people. That's, I believe, where it started.
You're right.
Right? Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, it started in when the White House was built, and that's why it's called the White House in Washington. Washington.
Yeah, it should be the colored house.
It was accelerated.
It should be the colored house and painted in a lot of colors, but then you get another problem maybe.
Look in other countries, they call it the castle. In Ghana, West Africa, they call it the castle. You know, these are places of where the presidents and the prime ministers are. They're called anything but the White House. They don't call it the Black House. They don't call it the Red House. They don't call it the Brown or Beige House. They call it a castle. Or they call it, what was the other one? The Parliament, that's where the legislative members are. But they could call it anything but the White House. And they say throughout years, the White House has been run by the Klan. So that's why we're having so many problems right now between the Republicans and the Democrats. We have the conservative Republicans who were probably raised in Klan homes. So we have major issues with the Klan. We got a lot of problems in the United States.
Yeah.
I want to drive this home just before I lose track of it because it's very, very important when we're talking about the way that we treat people or view people who are incarcerated.
Yeah.
This philosophy, this dismissive philosophy or this set of beliefs that people who are incarcerated should never have their freedom or be freed or treated as humans, that affects everybody incarcerated now, regardless of their color, which is why this is a point that we should be able to rally around, irrespective of our skin color, because it's truly about humanity.
Yeah,
if they were asked, would you like to be treated like black people in America have, nobody would stand up and say, sign me up. It wouldn't happen. But by being incarcerated, everybody in this day and age is effectively getting that same treatment. And we as people of color should be the first to be loyal or in service to those brothers and sisters. And the women have it absolutely worse when it comes to not having the things that they need inside of prison. And they have way less support. I know a lot of women who have a man in jail. I don't know of any of my guy friends who have, you know, a wife or a sister in there who they're supporting. And that's a shame. It's sad because they're much more vulnerable, much more isolated, and we hear nothing about them. That's something we got to work to change.
Yeah, I agree. I really agree. I think what you say, the dehumanization, that's the biggest issue. As soon as we objectify individual people, then that makes me think of the concentration camps of World War II and what is happening in Gaza now. When we objectify a person, then we can do what we want to do with that person. Then it doesn't matter anymore. And that's the big danger. That's what's happening in the prisons. The abuse, sexual abuse with women in prison and all that, they don't care. They don't care. Because inmates, it's about the inmate, quote unquote, the inmate, the label inmate, and the inmate is not human. So we don't care. That's what's happening in prison, and that scares the hell out of me.
Goodbye.
Are there people on the other side? I don't hear anything.
There are. I think we were just all taking a deep breath because we've said a lot, and in some ways we still have not even scratched the surface. We could talk about this around the clock. And in fact, I wish we were. I wish there was enough media who was focused on this issue. And they're popping up, individual media like us, like this Brenda, but nowhere near enough. I mean, this issue is serious enough. It's important enough that it should be a one vote type of decision, like our vote rests on who's going to bring the most change to the system of incarceration. But it's not yet, and that means
no.
we are at the beginning, or we are in the along the way, but definitely not near the end. But just somewhere on the path of incarceration, the evolution of incarceration, which I'll just restate, began with mass incarceration with the transatlantic passages, the middle passages they call them, slave trade, hundreds of years ago, and it evolved into what was called convict leasing. Now, this is the part of history that we don't teach our kids about. We teach them that in 1865, you know, everything just got better, and maybe not better enough, so we took another look in the 1960s and made it even better. It's not what happened. From the moment that it was illegal to put people in bondage just based on the color of their skin, we changed the law. And then went right back to grabbing out of that same pool of people who had just gotten an inch of relief, putting them right back in prison. And we as people of color failed to stand in allegiance with that part of our population. So we lost a good percent of our population, and we've never recovered. Today's version of this, or today's period along the same evolutionary line, leaves us with a very robust incarceration system where anybody can get it. And if you don't have enough money, you are screwed. You are liable to fall victim. But the place that we want to see our justice system go is not impossible. But we're not going to get there without conversations like this, without
maybe,
platforms like this.
Maybe
so we've got to continue to – go ahead. I'm sorry. I know I'm long.
No, I'm sorry. You were talking. Sorry.
No. I was wrapping up. That was really it. I was wrapping up. We've got – We've got to continue. We got to keep supporting these types of platforms.
Exactly.
Maybe the 13th Amendment should be rewritten. Just this gap, you know, that slavery is forbidden except when you have committed a crime. The exception should be left out. That's one
absolutely.
Of the things. Because that makes it possible to have slavery, and that's what you have inside the prison. And another thing what I want to add is I think that people should realize that mass incarceration in the United States is a mirror of society. What you see in the prison is a reflection of what's happening in society. So we can learn a lot from the prison system of what we should change in society, because mass incarceration is a consequence. It comes from society. It didn't fall out of the sky. It comes from that same society.
You know, when
I'm
I was
so
a kid,
glad you said that.
When I was a kid growing up on Cape Cod, when we listened to the news, it was not news about other countries. It was pretty much news about Massachusetts, right? You didn't hear about all this other, and so you didn't get all hyped up and everything. Then they started doing it on a broader level until it became a national level, and then it became an international level. So half the time people are listening to the news, they don't know if it's happening in their state, across the country, in another state. But it's like you said earlier, Marion, too, it's bringing in the fear. Then you mentioned what goes on Donna mentioned about the movies. These people, if they would stop taking the movies, if they would stop, you know, producing all these violent movies, and they get them from people's personal experiences, and they're putting fear into the communities nationwide. So if they would stop producing these violent movies, people say that they fear. Okay, if they fear, why are they so, and they don't like violence? If that's the case, why are they spending all this money to go to these movies, to go to the theaters, and to watch it on television? They enjoy the violence, but yet when it actually happens, they want to put these people away forever. Don't look at it in the first place. We have a lot of people in this country talking about mental illnesses again. A lot of people that are watching these type of movies. And what is it going to do to them? But put it in their minds to go out and do something like that. It's like when they advertise these little babies with these diapers, and they have these babies lying down with just a diaper on, and their legs up in the air. This is not normal. We have a country that is dysfunctional to be doing these kind of things, because these are exactly the things that are happening. I was watching CNN News just before this show, and they were questioning the CEOs of all these social media outlets. And they're talking to them about these children watching these things, getting involved, and a lot of these children have been harmed, seriously harmed, by getting involved. Well, it's up to the parents as well. The parents have the responsibility to make sure their kids are not on these social media sites interacting with people they don't know. So it's like you said, we need to do something about it. And the only way we can do something about it, like you, Kyle, said, Mariam has said, like Donna has said, people need to come together and talk about it. And the same people that come on this show every time there's a show, the same people that come on to talk about it are the only people so far that seems to be interested enough to try to do something about it. It's sick. It's sick because we have people out there that will talk amongst themselves, that will talk behind everybody's back, that will complain about the problem, and yet do absolutely nothing about it but talk. And we cannot resolve serious issues like we have in this country just by talking. We need to brainstorm. We need to get our political leaders involved, our government leaders, the lawmakers. We need to let them know they have to do more than just talk themselves. We got a serious problem in this country. Mental illnesses is one. You don't show violent movies on television when you know there are people out in society that are mentally ill that are going to try to do what they're watching. And I'm sorry, but I get upset when I talk about these things.
No, that's okay. That's okay.
As you should.
We need to also stop thinking about the past and move forward. So many people are so far back in the past that they can't see beyond that. And what we need to do is we need to stop coming together in unity around this country and working on these issues. The past, we can't change.
It was.
You know, Leona. Leona.
Yes.
Oh, this is Donna. Speaking of unity, you know, I grieve over the disproportionate amount of, you know, black and brown people being incarcerated and the grievances, and, you know, I'm in agreement, but I also work with everybody who is incarcerated, no matter whether what color they are. Some are white, some are not non-white, and, you know, their circumstances when they're imprisoned is, you know, they're all suffering. So therefore, when you say come together, you know, we have to come together for that population, you know, because the white people suffer as well. And it grieves my heart equally, each person, because I don't look at, you know, maybe it sounds funny, but I don't look at their color. I look at them as my fellow human persons. I look at them as people that are suffering. I look at them as people I care about. I actually feel a love for them, a deep, deep conviction for them, a burden for them, and I fight for each of them, no matter the color. And that's where, you know, we can come together. And yes, we must acknowledge, you know, the disproportionate numbers, but it's also, you know, it's anyone who is suffering this abuse in the carceral system.
And this is why I always say I admire Donna. She actually called a brother a brother. And this is what we need to do, is call brothers and sisters. That's what it should be. It shouldn't be any other way. But Donna interacts with anyone. She doesn't have any racism at all. But this is what I try to let people know, too. We're living in a country where there's a lot of racism, but there's a lot of people of the Caucasian race that are right by our side. When our own people, some of our own people, we can't even get to listen to their own. So that's why I say, if we were all coming together in unity, as Donna has come together with us, as Miriam and others like that, then we'd start seeing some real positive changes. And I want to say real quickly, we have about 4 minutes left. So Miriam, I want you to give the audience your information again, and then Donna and Kyle as well, if you want to. But if you can do that, then we can finish up with the topic.
Okay, I have a website, www.deeperjustice.com. You can find me there. You can read about my book and about a documentary that I have been cooperating with. I'm on Facebook, and I have also my page, Deeper Justice. I'm on Instagram with my own name. I'm on LinkedIn, and that's it. Too much media.
No, that's just right. That's the kind of media we want. And Donna?
To get a free quarterly newsletter, which is full of carceral information, you know, working with legislation, et cetera, and just sometimes the inmates' voices, we publish those. So you can go to fimi.inquiry@gmail.com. We also have a blog, which also is informational, fimi.blog. And now we have a Facebook page, so you would just check out fimi-ji, and that's for Justice Involved.
And Donna, you've been working, trying to get the Department of Mental Health to get involved, and you've been trying to get the hospitals, Mass General, you've been trying to get people from the hospitals to go in and do independent work as well, which is really needed. And I want to thank you for that. Kyle, if you don't have anything to say, then we can move on with what you were talking about and what Miriam and Donna were talking about.
I'll encourage everyone to check out on YouTube the channel Incarcerated Excellence, where I'm hopefully showcasing people who are who have expertise in different areas and have exercised it despite their incarceration. And I encourage everyone to check it out and listen to any one of the videos at random. I've got a few hundred more that I intend to add on that I've already recorded. But, you know, consider as you listen to these people, if you think any one of them should be thrown away for life, and carrying on, and that's what I want you to, if you want to contact me or find out more about what I do, that's the avenue to do it. The message that I'll say is kind of in line with that. And I'll just ask anyone who can hear my voice to just close your eyes and think about what the world would look like for you if there was no such thing as forgiveness. How would your family life look? How would your marriage look?
Oh, she said that on Facebook. She's out of the will.
I mean, people would be splitting up over politics. Marriages would be split up over dumb reasons. Societally, we would throw people in prison for the rest of their lives with no chance of redemption. I'm not talking in hypotheticals. These are our reality. We have this absurd estrangement with or from forgiveness, and because of that, we've got this inhuman attachment to revenge, to spite, and this punitive model. I want to encourage everybody to just begin. Remember that forgiveness starts with us individually. We have to continue to exercise it because the system does what we do. We had bondage of black people and racism before we had this version of mass incarceration. If we want to see forgiveness, second chances, parole opportunities extended at the societal level, which we do, we need to remember to bring that to our life every day with people around us where we can. And I'll leave it there.
Thank you so much. And John, I mean, Maryam, I hope that you'll come back soon because, you know, this topic that we were discussing today, this is a very important topic. And like I say, with what you do, what Don has been doing in the communities, trying to bring these people into the prisons, the independent, Kyle's been coming on a lot to talk about the issues as well. And I appreciate you, Kyle, for doing that because we really need input like yours as well. So if we can, Maryam, if we can at some point in time try to work out something where you can come back in a few weeks or whenever you have availability, I truly would appreciate it.
I love it. And, I love to. Thank you, Leona.
And Donna, again, you're a true warrior as well. You know, you've been sticking to it. And in this state, we need just people like you to go after the Department of Mental Health in the hospitals and to try to get them involved. It's their responsibility because if we have, just like the United States Postal Service, it's supposed to cover everyone in the United States, not just as far as the prison doors and walk away and let the prison mailroom take over because a lot of prisoners don't get their mail. That goes with the same with the Department of Mental Health. It's supposed to be a national thing. It's supposed to be helping all incarcerated with the mental health issues, and yet they've been lax-y-daisy, especially getting involved. American Psychological Association, they're getting all this funding for research. What are they doing with the research? They're not even doing anything with it. We know the problem. We need their help going into the prisons and helping these mentally ill people. So I thank you all for coming on again, Maryam. I'm looking forward to you having you back on as soon as possible so we can finish up on this discussion because this really makes a lot of difference. And I hope our legislative members know to start doing more than just talking about these issues, to especially the lawmakers. You know, they go into the prisons, the Department of Corrections, and they want to know all that the Department of Corrections is doing so they can decide whether they're going to defund or increase or keep the funding that they have. Well, the Department of Corrections, unless they have oversight, the lawmakers are not going to get their honest answers. They're not going to get the honest answers. So we need to focus, too, on oversight within the penal system nationwide. And I thank everyone for being on. Again, thank you, Maryam, thank you, Donna, and thank you, Kyle. Audience, we are now going to end this episode. Thank you all for listening in.